The recording is starting late because I stupidly forgot to turn on the recorder for the first 15 minutes. Sorry about that. We are going through the theater problem that's in the book and on the PowerPoints in some detail. So we now have our team accounts, which show cash coming in and either being shown as a revenue for the gift of the tickets, or being shown as going out to balance the costumes and to balance the cost of our rental, or as being the liability of deferred income, because that's money that this year owes to next year, because next year is actually going to have to do the work that this money is paying. So that goes fine, and I don't remember whether I have a second. Yes. Costumes don't last forever, so where would depreciation go in all of this? All right, we've got these things balanced. All right, so you'll notice that at the moment, none of this ends up on the cost statement so far. Right, as far as we're concerned, we paid $1,000 and we got $1,000. There are the costumes. But alas, actors are less careful than they ought to be with their clothing, and time has its way, and moths occasionally get in. So as a matter of fact, we have found that on average, costumes last for about 4 years. So now, how do we account for that in these, write this one out, how do we account for that in the fee accounts?
Ready? Depreciation.
And then one, depreciation.
It reduces, it's a credit to the asset.
Depreciation is a
debit.
Debit credit. Depreciation is a debit of minus $250. So we bought those at the beginning of the year, so they had a year to wear out. And where does that, wait a minute, is that? No, I'm wrong. It's a credit because depreciation is making us worse off.
No, because you're going to do that for the equipment, aren't you?
You've got a point there. I guess you're right. I guess I need two pairs of these are going to go on. I think you've got to be right. That's $250 for a credit for the equipment, which is worse off. And that's balanced by $250 of depreciation. I don't like that because I want to get that onto the cost line somewhere, right? Doesn't depreciation end up in cost? The good question, which I don't know the answer. Eventually depreciation is going to end up in the income statement, right? But maybe it gets its own one and then goes into the income statement at the end, maybe. I'm guessing that this is right, that depreciation is its own fee account. All right, so now at the, I'm saying goes to expenses, which I think it eventually does, but I'm not sure whether it actually goes there immediately or whether we have it this way. Anybody know? I don't. All right. Whether we need a separate depreciation. So we now want to close things out. And what do we have? We want an income statement. And our income statement tells us, so income statement, what was our revenue? Our revenue was $4,000, so I haven't missed it. What were our costs? Well, operating expenses, more or less, were $1,000. That was the rental. But we also have this term for depreciation, which is $250. Have I missed anything? don't think I've missed anything. So we have.
I think doing these like depreciation expense and then accumulated depreciation. You have a decount with accumulated depreciation, so you're not taking it directly out of.
That what isn't that what we're doing? That I'm doing a depreciation.
Well, up there the depreciation is an expense.
Yes.
And then
the question is, does it actually go on my income T account, or does it go on a separate depreciation T account because the income statement doesn't have an item for depreciation? Isn't it? That's right. You subtract depreciation out because that's a cost. But either way, it looks as though our that stuff ought to be revenue minus expenses is 3,000 minus that is 250. So it looks as though we've got $2,750 of net income, and it looks as though if we wanted to look at our cash, account, what did we start out with? $2,000. And looking at the cash T accounts, we observe that we got five and spent two. So plus 5,000 minus 2,000 is going to give us $5,000 in cash. And in terms of our equipment for the balance, that's just how much cash we're going to have for our balance sheet. For the equipment, it's actually not, this number isn't right because I'm not winning my depreciation. So we started out with $3,000 worth of costumes, got $1,000 there. Whereas, why do I have minus $1,000? That's got to be wrong. Minus 250 for the depreciation, all right? So we ought to have 3,000. Where is minus? What do I have? Oh, that's not a minus sign. That's this silly PowerPoint. It's using these to mark that level of the outline. So it's 3,000 plus 1,000, but it should be minus 250 if the depreciation was only a quarter of it. What?
Worth the 3,000 for the costumes?
That's where I started with, I think. We remember we had a balance sheet at the beginning. Let me go back and check it. But I'm pretty sure that's right. That we had costumes and sets for 3,000 to start. And so we then got another 1,000 but depreciated 250. So that would be 3,750 in equipment. And what am I missing? We have to have in liabilities somewhere our $1,000 of deferred income. So these are all assets, but in liabilities we have $1,000 deferred income. All right. And that ought, we then have our surplus, our income here from the year of 2750. So we started out, anybody remember how much surplus we started out with?
Started out with $1,000 in surplus. We have $4,000 bank loan
from before. Surplus used to be 1,000 plus, I think it was 2750, I said. 50. That ought, if I've got it right, to tell us that our current surplus is 3,750. If I made any mistakes, it would be surprising. 5,000. Oh, wait a minute. $8,750 minus $5,000, amazing. So it actually works, right? The
equation indeed balances. So we've successfully done that one. All right. So using the information, you could imagine a potential donor who wants to look at the income statement and says, hey, these people are doing pretty well for themselves. They're taking in money faster than they're paying it out. That looks good. Potential lender, we say, well, look, you can see that we've got a surplus of $3,750. The potential lender looks at this and, is the surplus really going to answer his question? What might he wonder about? If the lender says, look, I'm afraid you did pretty well this year, but you might do badly next year. How do I know I get paid back? And we say, well, look, our surplus is $3,750, so we're good for at least that much. And what's his reply? What's going to happen to that surplus if the company goes broke?
Pay it out.
What?
You pay it out.
Well, how are they going to pay it out? That surplus, the cash I believe in, maybe. But the surplus, if the company actually goes broke, what are going to happen to those assets?
Company needs to pay out the liability.
Yeah, but how are they, in fact, are the assets going to in fact be the size they say they are?
Probably, I mean, if they're recorded at the surplus cost.
And in fact, what do you think is going to happen if you're running a theater company that goes broke and you've got $3,750 worth of costumes and sets? How much do you think you could sell those for?
Yeah,
so like 10%. Yeah, 50 cents on the dollar, 10 cents on the dollar. So in fact, if you are the lender, you are going to say, well, surplus is all very well, but I want to know how much of that surplus is coming from equipment which is not liquid and which you can't liquidate. Well, I say, but that's all right. We've got $5,000 of cash. And he says, yeah, sure, you've got $5,000 of cash. You also have a $4,000 bank loan. Does that have priority over my loan? If it does, you only have $1,000 to pay me back if something goes wrong, plus whatever you use the money I lend you, of course, for. So, you know, if I lend you $2,000, you'll have $2,000. And furthermore, he may wonder about whether you've got a real obligation to the customers next year, which you're going to have to fulfill and you've already been paid for. So next year's, in terms of cash is concerned, is not going to look so good because you're going to have to spend money producing programs and $1,000 of the tickets you aren't going to get because you've already got it. So all of those things are going to be relevant to his decision, and you can see how the different statements provide different kinds of information relevant. So what have we done? We had an asset which eventually ended up in equity only. It's called surplus here, which was via the income statement, which is the donation. An asset converted to another use, cash to costumes. Cash that was balanced with income, the ticket sales, which eventually go to equity after netting out the costs. An expenditure balanced with an expense. Rental, which will go to the income statement as a cost, an asset balanced with a liability to the future, the money we were paid plus the advanced sales that we owe next year, and depreciation. So we've done lots of accounting kinds of things, even though we're doing a pretty simple example. Let's go back for a minute to this matching principle that we're theoretically supposed to understand. And the theory is that revenue is allocated to the period during which effort is expended in generating it, and expense is allocated to the period in which the benefit from it will contribute to income generation. But effort allocation is a little bit tricky, and so one question which occurs to me is, if expense occurs in year one and revenue in year two, we know we want to put them together, but how do we decide whether we move forward or back? Whether do we say, let's shift the expense forward as a prepaid expense and balance it with the revenue that it earns, or do we say, let's move the revenue back? How do you move the revenue back? I guess you would have to say that you've created, I don't know how you would do that, but I think think you could do it. You could say we've paid and our payment has given us an asset which we are going to consider as bought and added to our inventory this year, and that's going to eventually show up on our balance sheet. So an expense this year for income next year. A possible argument would be we don't know the amount of the income, so we move it forward as prepaid expenses and deferred income. But accounts receivable is the case where we haven't been paid, but we expect to. And in that case, you move it back. And theoretically, when you have a accounts receivable, you know how much money people owe you, even if they haven't paid it to you yet. And you know what you've already paid to do it. So it makes some sense to do it that way. What do you think happens when the accounts receivable don't get received? What? Maybe, but the ordinary write-off is bad debts or something like that, however, whatever the proper terminology. So at that point, you're going to take a cost of bad debts on and a corresponding reduction in your accounts receivable in your assets. Now, I want to argue with the authors of the book because I don't think that conservative bias really describes what the accountants are doing. Because what they mean by a conservative bias pretty clearly is a bias in the direction of understating the value of a firm. I think if you look at that part of the chapter, that's what they mean by conservative. And I don't think that accurately describes it, because if you look at the pattern of the rules, some of them understate and some of them overstate. So if we have a world where prices trend up, in a world where prices trend up, then using historical cost will tend to underestimate the value of the firm. That's true. On the other hand, if you have a world where firms are often sued for things where the odds are better than even that they'll win, then treating the cost due to those suits at zero, when there may be many such suits, overestimates the value of the firm, because it doesn't recognize that if you've got 10 suits, you're going to lose one of them and you have to pay some money on that one. So I don't think it's consistent. Furthermore, the point I make on the slide, if you're thinking about evaluating how successful a firm has been at earning income, you're actually going to get it backwards, because if a firm buys something for $1,000, it holds it long enough for 100% inflation, it now sells it for $2,000. According to the accountants, it's made a profit of $1,000 on that. On the other hand, if I'm a stockholder, I'll say they've made no money at all on that, because after all, the $2,000 they sold it for will buy them just as much, or buy me just as much, as the $1,000 they wanted for. So in fact, one of the things you may want to, in fact, an interesting thing to think about would be, suppose you're in a society which sometimes has quite sizable inflation rates. Right? The U.S. in recent years hasn't. It wouldn't be astonishing if it went back to high inflation over the next 5 or 10 years, given things that are going on, and the U.S. did have inflation rates, not high by world standards, but of significantly over 10% within my lifetime for a noticeable length of time. In a world with inflation rates, what are the ways in which you might want to modify accounting to take account of it? It's an issue which is relevant not just to accounting for businesses, but also to how the tax system works.
You start pegging growth to over the rate of inflation.
We say pegging growth. I don't know.
So if you sell that that item, you only consider it income or profit if you sold it for over the rate of inflation.
Putting it differently, you could say the cost of this item was $1,019.50.
Yeah, we adjusted.
However, a $1,950 equals $2,990. So if we're selling it in 1990, we say since we're selling it for $1,990, we ought to convert the cost into $1,990, just as we would do if we'd bought it for pounds and had to convert that into dollars. And therefore, the real cost is the nominal cost times the proportional increase in the price index in the interval, and you could do your accounting that way. Think about capital gains tax. All right, capital gains tax. On the one hand, capital gains are taxed, I think, still at a lower rate than regular income. On the other hand, when you have inflation, capital gains are in part imaginary. Because you buy a stock for $10,000, you hold it for 20 years, you sell it for $20,000, capital gains $10,000, you pay tax on that, real gain zero because the dollar's lost half its value in the meanwhile. All right, so now, I don't know. It'd be an interesting question if any of you actually got seriously involved in this. If you looked at countries like, say, Israel, which within our lifetime have had really serious inflation rates, how do they handle that? In fact, suppose you, that's an interesting question. Suppose you were an accountant in Israel, and let us leave aside any questions. Wouldn't that be Israel? The other country, which is true, it's one of them. What? Yeah, Zimbabwe is hopeless, though. Though, in fact, it does raise the interesting. Suppose you were doing business in Zimbabwe. How would you deal with the fact that the money is inflating at a phenomenally high rate?
Barter.
You could do better than barter. That's right. You would use some foreign currency. You would use dollars or pounds or euros or something. Yeah, well, that's right. But you would want to use... And, in fact, I gather that what actually happened in Israel when they had high inflation rates, I'm told, is they did business in the Israeli pound, I think it was at the time, but they did contracts in dollars. Because if you're doing a contract for future performance, it matters a good deal how the value of the money is going to change over time, and relatively speaking, the dollar was a stable currency. And you could imagine, and I don't know, maybe countries just do it, where the accounting is all done in dollars or all done in euros rather than in the local currency, because it gives you a more consistent measure. I know very little about the real world in this respect, but it seems to make sense, and I wouldn't be surprised if some people do. So in any case, the claim I want to make is if you really look at the bias in accounting, it's not a conservative bias, but a skeptical bias. That it's a bias in the direction of saying, ignore anything which is hard to measure. And that bias, it seems to me, makes a good deal of sense if you are worried that people involved in producing the numbers have an incentive to have the numbers come out one way or another. Because if that's the case, as it often is for accounting, the more flexible the system is, the more the results will reflect what somebody wants to get rather than what's happening in the real world. I suppose I won't ask you to confess to your own sins on filling out tax forms. I could probably confess to my sins on filling out tax forms a long time ago. Maybe the statute of limitations has passed. But as I remember, and I think it may even have been legal, I'm not sure, although it certainly was not correct, so to speak, I had a home office. This home office represented, let me say, 5% of my house, so I depreciated 5% of the value of the house. And, of course, values of housing were going up, not down, so that was quite a large deduction from my income for book royalties and speeches and such, which reflected no real cost at all, only an accounting cost. And you could think of a variety of other things that you could do if you exercised your ingenuity in trying to make yourself richer and the government poorer, which all come into that general category. All right. So if they err in the direction of ignoring things hard to measure, so that intangibles only count if they're bought at a price, and use market value for financial assets where it's easily determined. Can you see ways in which that might still let people fudge things? What's the obvious way with those rules in which you fiddle it so that the accounting looks the way you want it to look instead of the way it really is? Given that set of rules. Because obviously it might turn out to be wrong. But suppose I wanted my accounts... Well, there are a number of things. Suppose, for example, I wanted the company to look better in terms of the various measures. What are some obvious things to do? Let me start with things that are entirely legal. All right, I'm the CEO, and I want our income statement to show that we've made lots of money this year. Because there's going to be a proxy fight and they're going to try to get rid of me. I want to be able to say, look at our income statement, big income. What are some obvious ways that I can increase the income statement that don't really, in any meaningful sense, increase the income?
Write in your income.
accounts receivables?
As cash?
Yeah, though I'm not sure I'm going to be, I'm not sure an accountant will let me do this. I was thinking not of lying on the accounts, but of making business decisions designed to leverage the imperfections of the accounting rules. Given these rules, what's one very simple way of, on paper, making income? Anybody? No fraud involved, no dishonesty involved. It's just a perfectly normal business decision, which, as far as I can tell, will increase accounting income while having no effect on real income. Nobody. I'm not going to hire any of you guys to run dishonest companies, I'll tell you that. Consider any asset whose accounting value is much lower than its real value. Say the land that you bought 20 years ago. What's the obvious way of getting income? Sell it, right? So your factory is on some land. The land is much more valuable than it was. You sell the land your factory is sitting on and lease it back. Since the land was bought for $1 million and is now worth $10 million, you have $9 million in income that you've just gotten as a result of that sale. Wouldn't have to be land. Suppose you've got a really valuable brand name. And you didn't buy it, you built it. Well, you're selling a number of different products, you don't have to keep that particular brand name, so you sell the brand name to somebody else, that's income. But there was no cost, you didn't lose any assets because the brand name was a zero value asset because it wasn't bought. All right. So the first point I'm making, and it's sort of relevant if you think of yourself in the real world advising clients, is the client says, this firm is doing great, I should be willing to lend them money or to invest in them or something. Look, here's their balance sheet. Here's their income statement. And one of the things that you might want to ask yourself is the reason the income statement is so large that they have taken valuable assets and sold them when the asset's accounting basis was much less than the actual value? Now suppose you're a little bit less honest. And suppose you would like to, this year, you want your company to show a $10 million gain, which is fictitious, and you're planning to skip the country next year, so you aren't worried about legal consequences. How can you do it in such a way that, as far as the accountant, you've got honest accountants, the accountants are going to write down what they see. What's the obvious way of getting a $10 million gain without actually making any money? Given that you say it only has to last till January 1st. Don't you learn anything nowadays? I mean, how do you expect to survive as scam artists if you don't? Or protect yourself against scam artists, more important. Nobody has a scheme for... What? A loan? Yeah, but the loan... But if your accountants are honest, they're going to see the loan on your books as this liability. You've got to have income on your books without a large connected cost, which income, as far as your accountants looking at your books, will see as real, despite the fact that it's fictional. The scheme I'm going to use is much simpler than that. I set up a second firm, which my accountants aren't going to see because they're not doing accounts for the second firm. And the second firm buys from the first firm for $10 million a brand name or some other thing which actually isn't very valuable. Maybe is really worth nothing and worth nothing on the books. And they agree that they will pay early next year. All right, so we've got some accounts receivable for $10 million. That's an asset. We've got no reduction in assets because the brand name not only was actually worthless, it was worthless on the accounts too because we didn't buy it from anybody. So we now have a $10 million income. And nothing, there is nothing as far as our accountants are concerned to make them deny that this is a correct set of accounts. January 1st, I skip the country, at which point somebody discovers that this firm that owes us $10 million has no assets at all, being a shell company that I created. All right. So what point about accounting does that sort of emphasize? Point that the book makes. I should say, I gather that variants of this scheme were how Enron ran. Basically, Enron made lots of money by selling things to firms that weren't going to pay them. Suppose I'm doing it the other way around, of course, which is equally. Suppose this time that what I want to do, I don't care about firm number one's statements. Well, I do care about them. I don't want them to look bad, but I'm not trying to make them look good. All I'm trying to do, I have a very modest objective, and that is to steal $10 million. All right? And I'm the CEO, and I want to steal, again, I'm going to skip town next year. So I want to steal $10 million from my firm in a way that will not show up on the books. In such a way, I don't mean that the transaction won't show up, but in such a way that if people are looking at the firm's assets, they have not gone down by $10 million or anything at all. They look at the firm's income, it isn't $10 million lower than it should have been. So how do I steal $10 million from my firm? People just don't have proper criminal minds. I don't know how you can practice law. What do I do in order that when my accountants look at the books, they say assets and liabilities just about the same as last year, no big change, but as a matter of fact, the company has $10 million less and I have $10 million more. And again, I'm going to use a shell company. I'm going to use a fictitious second company that I have created for the purpose. And what is that second company going to do this time?
The second company instead sells something to the company.
That's right. The second company sells a brand name or an invention or a patent, which happens to be worthless. As far as the accountants are concerned, when company one buys a brand name that nobody's ever heard of from company two for $10 million, for accounting purposes, what is the value of the asset of that brand name? $10 million. That's initial historical cost, right? So if I do that, the accounts for company one, which is what has real assets, will show nothing odd. I mean, we're buying and selling stuff all the time. It's not the accountant's business. It's the accountant's business to make sure that if I claim I have inventory, the inventory is really there, at least to spot check it when they do an audit. But I don't think it's normally their business to figure out what the value is of a brand name. How would they know? So at that point, January 1st, I get my tickets for, what's a good country that doesn't have extradition with the U.S. nowadays?
You're a French citizen, Polanski.
So French citizens do not, they won't, can they extradite? You have to not only be a French citizen, but a French citizen the French government likes?
I think they have to like you.
And I don't know how you get to be a French citizen that easily, but there's got to be somewhere in the world which is nice to live where you can't get extradited because, you know, markets work and there's a market for such a country. And so you take off for that on January with your $10 million, of course. And leave it to other people to notice that you have a $10 million asset whose real value is zero. So in both of these cases, what's the real problem? What is? And one of the problems is the rules for recognizing the value of assets. You're recognizing accounts receivable as if they were really going to be paid without knowing if they're going to be paid, and you're recognizing the value of a brand name and what you paid for it without deciding whether it's actually worth anything.
Well, it depends, because if an accountant is, so you're saying, let's say you sell the company a brand for $1 billion. The accountant's going to be like, well, what brand is this?
Yes.
I've never heard of such
yes.
a brand.
And yeah, I agree.
There's
some limit to how big you can get away with. But what's the other part? What's the other problem in what's going on, which accountants do worry about and have to worry about? And that's the definition of the entity.
Yeah.
That essentially I'm doing all of these tricks by really having, as it were, one entity, part of which is my shell company, which is out of the eyesight of the accountants, and part of which is the real company that's in the eyesight. And by doing that, I'm able to pull off these various tricks. Incidentally, if any of you want to
combine recreational reading with a very small amount of accounting information. There is a series of mysteries by, I'm now forgetting the names of the authors, it was really two people, one of them was a lawyer and one an economist. The detective is a man called Thatcher, who is the executive vice president of the second largest bank in the world, if I remember in the stories. And one of the stories is called Accounting for Murder. And it's quite a good story in which really, in a sense, the hero is the accountant who gets murdered as it happens. But the trick of the whole story is figuring out what the fraud is that the accounts reveal. There is, in fact, a field of forensic accounting. I know because somebody once invited me to speak at a conference on money laundering in the Pacific Rim. And he introduced himself by saying he was a forensic accountant. And I told him, I asked him if he realized that I was in favor of money laundering, and he said yes. So it was fun. But in any case, it's a fun story. Accounting for Murder, I recommend it. Emma Lathan. Emma Lathan is the name of the author. Pretty good light fiction. All right. So the problem is defining an entity. Financial accounting describes the financial condition of an entity, but activities affect two or more entities. So if you think about it from a purely practical standpoint, if you have two entities, one of which is you, whose expenditures or consumption are not deductible, and one of which is your small business, which is producing books and lectures and whatever else you sell, then the way to reduce your taxes is, wherever possible, to treat expenditures as business expenses for the business entity rather than as consumption expenditures for yourself. And, of course, there are IRS rules to try to limit your ability to do this, but they're not watching and you are, so that, you know, if you say, well, you know, this dinner was a business expense. Why was it a business expense? Well, I was having dinner with somebody who might hire me to give him a speech. Well, they have no way of knowing the probability that that person will hire you. And in fact, it was a dinner with a good friend of yours. And it's true that the good friend of yours is also got some connection with some entity that might hire you to give a speech. But that's not why you went out to dinner with him. I should say, at the point when it's no longer even arguably legal, I can remember many years ago going out to dinner with a bunch of people who had ideological objections to taxes, and the protocol in their dinners was that you first auctioned off the right to pay for the dinner with a credit card on the theory that whoever paid for the dinner would then write it off as a business expense. And you then auctioned off the right, I think, to take the check. I think if I remember correctly, they had two different people both claiming to have paid for the entire dinner as a business expense and agreeing to pay the other diners part of their meal in exchange for the tax credits. Well, of course, the latter bit happens legally in the context where a firm buys another firm, in part because the second firm has losses, which will be deductible against the first firm's taxes. That's perfectly legitimate. But things like home office, all right, how in practice do we decide? I don't try to deduct a home office anymore, but I did at one point. I think they tightened up the rules. But how do you decide? If you've got a room in your house which has a computer in it and you use the computer for playing World of Warcraft, but also for writing books on, what determines the proportion? There isn't a practical way for them to know, and therefore there are lots of ways. One of the implications of all of this is that to some extent an income tax system makes incomes less equal. And the respect in which it makes less equal is that some people are in a better position than others to in various ways reduce their taxable income. So if you imagine two people who are doing the same thing, and one of them is a author who is hired by a firm on a salary to write stuff for the firm, and the other is a freelance writer. Even if their real income is the same, the freelance writer is going to end up with more money.
because the freelance writer is going to have a whole bunch of fuzzy areas where he can plausibly claim something as a business expense and where it's sort of a business expense but not entirely a business expense, whereas the employee has got a fixed visible salary, expenses are either paid by his company or not, and so forth. And so that's going to be respectable, which makes it less equal. There was a point, I think, at which I was deducting computer games, but the argument for doing that was that I had, in fact, written some computer programs as part of a textbook that I had gotten money for, was working on designing some computer programs to teach economics, which were basically game-like things, and therefore computer games are obviously research expenditures for engaged in producing income. That was a bit of a stretch, and, you know, if somebody had audited me, I might have had to give up on that. But, of course, one of the features of the IRS is that most of the time you're not audited, and that, therefore, if you have something which is close enough to correct so that you can plausibly say you believed it was right, even if they finally decide it isn't, you're not in. All you've got to do is to give them the money. But anyway, the basic point here is that in terms of defining an entity, for reducing your taxes, you step things up so that things that are really consumption expenditures can be seen as business expenditures. And in the other direction, that you have to worry if you're, say, a lender, that you know exactly what the entity is that's liable for the debt. So that if you say, well, you know, his father's a multimillionaire, of course I can lose him. I can lend him money. And it's nice to know whether the father will, in fact, pay the son's debts. And if he won't, then maybe you better not lend him money. And similarly, if you think about a firm, if you're lending money to a subsidiary of General Motors, you had better know whether or not General Motors is liable for the debt, because if not, you might not get paid. So that's all has to do with the question of where the lines around an entity are, and I don't think it's always clear where the lines around an entity are. I was thinking of this from a practical standpoint in terms of Santa Clara Law School. As it happens, I don't know the terms of the law school's arrangements with the university, but I do know that when I was a professor at Tulane Business School many years ago, that they did have and it was literally a contract or maybe a memo of understanding with the university, which defined, in effect, of money that the business school took in, how much the university was entitled to get. And that was a case where I think the university ended up, in effect, breaking the contract, because Tulane Business School had an extraordinarily enterprising dean by the name of Mayor Feldberg, who was, I think I worked out, he was raising $200,000 a month. At the point I knew the figures, and they ended up building a beautiful new business school building, and Mayor then and switched to being president of IIT, and later he was the dean of the business school at Columbia, which is an even better business school than Tulane. But while he was at Tulane, he was raising a lot of money, and the university wanted a cut of that money and weren't entitled to it under the agreement. So there was tension over that. But the basic point I'm making is that if you think about that kind of a relationship where you've got a sort of semi-independent unit like a law school within a university, there are going to be some agreements saying, all right, the university is providing your heating and electric power. You owe the university 10% of your tuition revenue to pay for things like that. And there may be things where the university is providing your student record services, and they charge you a certain amount to do that. You can think of, again, I don't know what the arrangements are here. All of that involves accounting. And all of the accounting is going to involve some decisions by the people in the law school and the university about what counts as what. So if you wanted, if the deal was that revenue minus cost, 20% of it goes to the university, then the law school would want to find versions of accounting which made costs look high, at least current costs look high. If the situation was that you were trying to raise money and you knew that the guy who you hoped would give you $10 million was the sort of tight-fisted businessman who said, if you can't make money, I'm sure you're not going to pour any money into you, you would then want to do the accounting which made ways that made your profit look good. So those are all issues where it would be worth thinking about as a practical matter how you do the accounting. So Enron, I'm writing through the example before, that you sell something to your invisible entity for much more than it's worth, or buy something from that entity for much less than it's worth, which makes it look as though your company is making a profit, and sales can be accounts receivable, so it doesn't require any real money. And the alternative the other way, of course, is my $10 million purchase from my entity, which is one where until my company goes bankrupt, it looks like it's doing fine, and yet I end up going away very well. So that's one reason that one of the things lawyers have to worry about is whether transactions are arm's length transactions or not. To run through a little bit another problem that's in the book, which has to do with the timing stuff on the FIFO, LIFO, and that stuff, that if an asset increases by $300 for services next year, then deferred income is $300. We went through that when going through our theater a minute ago, 15 minutes ago. It's a liability because it's money this year's firm owes next year's. Next year, the deferred income goes down 300, revenue goes up 300, misspelled, and thus you're balancing each time and you're shifting your income into the proper year. Right? Allocating costs, let's consider this problem of which gallons we're using when. So we buy oil at $1 a gallon this year and more at $2 a gallon next year, they go in the same tank. How do you do the accounts for the inventory? So let's take that problem, page 146 of the book. We buy 1,000 gallons of oil at $1 a gallon. And so what do? We credit cash. That's debit, that's credit, so on the other side. Buy 1,000. And you debit inventory. I'm not sure it's worth actually writing them out since we've done these T accounts already, but let's just run through what's happening. We sell 500 gallons of oil at $1 a gallon, no problem. We know that the oil in inventory is all $1 a gallon inventory, so therefore inventory is credited by $500. We have less oil than before, and the cost of goods sold, which is in the income statement, is debited by $500. Somewhere there ought to be some cash there, too, shouldn't there? Yeah. So we ought also... So where we sold the $500, we ought also to be debiting cash with $500 and crediting income with $500. Does that sound right? Yeah. We now buy another 500 gallons at $2 a gallon. We credit cash with 1,000, debit inventory with 1,000. And now life gets interesting because we sell 500 gallons of mixed $1 and $2 a gallon oil. So under LIFO, we say that we have credited the inventory with $1,000 because under LIFO, last in, first out, that was $2 a gallon gasoline. Under FIFO, it would be $500. We debit cost of goods sold by $1,000 under LIFO, by $500 under FIFO. What's missing? What have I left out of this? Of some significant importance. There's another T account here somewhere. What happens when I sell 500 gallons? I get money, right? Green stuff. For some reason, the book doesn't tell us what I sold it for. But you ought to know, and if you sold it for $3 a gallon, let us say optimistically, then we will have cash debiting by $1,500. And what's the credit that balances that? Income credits by $1,500, exactly. So that's missing from this picture. And where does it go? It goes to income, which eventually is going to go into your equity. How do you choose between LIFO and FIFO? I don't have a good answer to that question. That is, I guess, the answer. You know, I was discussing this with somebody at the end, with one of you at the end last time, and I couldn't believe the answer that each year you get to decide, because if you get to decide each year, then you could drive your reported income down, but for IRS purposes, by saying whenever FIFO makes my cost higher, I will use FIFO, and whenever LIFO makes my cost higher, I will use LIFO, with the result that my 500 gallons of $2 oil, I sell 1,000 gallons of that out of that 500 gallons. That can't be right. I don't believe it. I mean, the IRS is not that stupid, is it?
No.
No. So how do they do it? What are the rules on changing?
I'm not certain, but I think that when you do change it, you have to make corrections for the past maybe 3 years or something.
Uh-huh.
And so, I mean, it's possible that you could still obtain a gain in changing one, but I think they add some barriers. At least you can't just change it year to year.
Yeah. All right. I don't know, but it does seem as though that would be one of the relevant questions. Now, depreciation, we've just been doing it, but you buy your computer for $2,000. I think a good deal of my tax stuff is done automatically by computer program, and I've noticed occasionally that it's taking depreciation for stuff that I stopped using 5 years ago, and presumably at whatever point I put it in, it had a 10-year or 8-year or something schedule for things, even though computer stuff doesn't last that long, so depreciating things that no longer exist, essentially. So at the point where you buy the computer, one possibility is you pay your cash is down by the price and your equipment is up by that amount. And then there's no effect on your income or on your equity. On the other hand, at some point, the computer gets used up. It's neither like an ordinary input that's used up in the year you bought it, nor something that lasts forever. So if you think its lifetime is 4 years, then at the end of a year, you credit your equipment by $500. You now have a $1,500 computer instead of a $2,000 computer. You debit depreciation, which is going to be an expense, $500. The expense goes into the income statement, from there into retained earnings, making them less and equity less. All right, so that's the mechanics. On the other hand, since nobody knows how long the computer will be useful, there is some range over which you can juggle the numbers to make the firm look good or bad, depending what you want to do. So those are things to at least worry about when looking at a company's statements. And I'm assuming, in a sense, that the real framework for most of this from a practical standpoint is that at some point in the future you will be a lawyer who is looking at the accounting statements of a company for some reason. And the reason could be to figure out whether your client, who is a stockholder, ought to be suing the management for fraud. It might be to decide whether your client should be lending them money. Could be whether your client should be accepting their offer of a job. You can think of lots of different possible things, but that you're looking at their books to answer questions like that. Other complications that we've run through already, that intangible assets are usually ignored unless you bought them at an arm's length transaction, as opposed to my hypothetical case where the owner of a small firm becomes the CEO of a large firm and he buys the small firm's brand name for $50 million. How does this affect the balance sheet of the large firm? Does the large firm have more or less equity as a result of this? What asset's gone down? What asset has gone up?
No change.
They've got $50 million less cash, $50 million more brand name. Brand name is valued at its purchase price, so we're home free, right? And that's one problem with that rule, obviously, and that's one reason why you worry about arm's length transactions. On the other hand, it's not all that uncommon if a small startup is really successful that somebody else wants to absorb it, and when they're absorbing it, they may well hire the guy who started it to do something, and they may well be buying things that are intangible, so you can see why it might, maybe it's really worth $50 million, you'd have to know. The contingent liabilities we've run through before, and one of the things that bothers me about that is the problem if there are multiple contingent liabilities, because you could certainly imagine somebody saying, well, look, instead of asking what is the probability that each of these suits separately will end up costing you money, what is the probability that this portfolio of suits will end up costing you money? Much better than even. And I think they usually do it suit by suit, but that seems logically hard to defend. And then the final one in this list is extraordinary expenses. And extraordinary expenses do show up on the balance sheet, but they're listed separately. And there are sort of two obvious questions. One of them, as somebody who's reading a balance sheet, why do you want them separated? And the other is, as somebody who's writing a balance sheet, why might you choose to separate? So you're reading a balance sheet. Why do you care whether these are extraordinary expenses? The company says, look, not counting extraordinary expenses, we made $20 million this year. We had an extraordinary expense of $25 million, so we lost $5 million. Why is that anything different than just saying we lost $5 million this year?
Because you know exactly what it's for. It gives you better analysis of the company.
In particular, what might you conclude if you really think it is extraordinary?
That they're going to have a better year than next year.
That's right. That if it really is extraordinary, then this is not a description of last year or a description of next year. It's only something that happened this year. You'd have to. But of course, given, assuming people do that, what's the flip side of that? If you're the CEO, what is your obvious temptation?
To
get as many expenses as possible classified as extraordinary so as to persuade other people that you're doing a good job, and it was just that the previous CEO got you committed to paying, to being liable for the debts of some subsidiary, and the subsidiary went bust, and that's why you had to pay this expense, right? So, all right. Spend a couple of minutes at least. We don't have as much time as I thought we might, which is I want some one of you to volunteer to be the subject of an accounting exercise. And the accounting exercise is, what are your assets and liabilities at the beginning of the school year? What transactions have you made since then? What does that give you as an income statement? Assets, liabilities, cash accounts, T accounts. And, we aren't going to have time to do very much of it, but if we imagine at least starting that project, can somebody give me doesn't have to be truthful, but a not wholly imaginary list. I think I'm going to disconnect this so that I can use this part of the board this time. It would give me an imaginary but not wildly implausible account of assets and liabilities and beginning to be. So this is your balance sheet. Assets. Liabilities. So what liability might you plausibly have had at the beginning of this school year?
Loans.
What loans? Student loans.
Right.
All right. Let's be conservative, $50,000 student loans. I'll make up the numbers for you so you don't have to lie. What assets might you plausibly have had at the beginning of this year?
Cash, maybe?
Cash, 50 cents?
Yeah, seriously.
Car, $3,000?
Lucky.
What?
$3,000 would be lucky.
Yeah, right. You know his car. I don't know his car. Right. And so what is your surplus? Have we left anything out? Probably nothing very important. Books.
Is that an asset? Books?
They're equipment. Don't they count as equipment?
You can sell them for money.
Yeah,
but no, but wait a minute. We're accountants. It's how much you pay for them that matters.
And these books are expensive nowadays. They really are.
$500 worth of books. So, what are some plausible transactions that occurred during the year? How did you do things that an accountant would care about? He doesn't have to be the victim all the time. One of you can.
Well, obviously, you had food expenditures, right?
Yeah, sure. So,
food, shelter, water.
Food and rent.
And so food and rent goes where? In cash? Is it a debit or a credit?
Credit.
Rent's pretty expensive around here, so let's suppose $22,000 for the year, rent plus food. No idea how plausible that is, being a starving student at the moment, but let's make it that number. But there's got to be something to balance it, so where is that going to be balanced?
Rent, food, expense?
What?
Rent, expense? Rent, food, expense?
Huh. All right, let me put it that way. I was just going to put it on the income statement as a cost.
No worries.
So, $22,000 cost. Anything else? Did you make any trips to? It's really, if you made any trips to visit law firms that were going to hire you, they probably paid your expenses. So that won't do.
You went to Vegas.
What?
So you went to Vegas.
You went to Vegas for what?
Student loans.
What?
Betting on one hand.
You went to Vegas. Okay. So let's see. Well, I think we're out of time, so we won't have to find out all about your Vegas
Garden
adventures.
City.
What?
Garden City. You play the tournament, you win.
What is this, poker or some other game?
Poker.
Yes.
I want to play a house game. Why would I play a house game?
I don't know. So you're a serious poker player or not?
I play it, want to pick up some money. Just for fun or something.
So do you know my adult son who's got the same last name I do and is a mildly serious poker player?
No.